Recording in progress.
Mas intérprete, já está resolvido?
Session on promoting accountability within the SADC region involving parliamentarians in the use of public finance management in the implementation of measures to fight corruption. For this session, we have with us members from the Regional Parliamentary Oversight. We have three presenters who are experts on this matter. Presenter one, Mrs. Sarah Mundi, General Director, consultant from South Africa, recently conducted work at UNODC, where she performed a project analysis on regional performance reports on corruption 2021 and the 2018-2022 Action Plan Revisited. Mrs. Bondazi is a lawyer at the Superior Court and member of Civil Societies of South Africa. She has 35 minutes for her presentation. Would you please take the floor, Sarah?
Thank you, and good afternoon, Honorable Members of the SADC Parliamentary Forum, members of various parliaments, other guests and attendees at this meeting. I just want to share my screen. Thank you. As Honourable Madam Chair has indicated, today I am addressing you on how to use the public finance management to address corruption in the SADC region. To begin with, my presentation will give an overview on the prevalence of corruption in the SADC region, and the costs of corruption. In other words, why is it a matter of concern for the region? I will also outline a conceptual framework for parliamentary action at national and regional levels, and also strategies that parliaments can use to combat corruption, in particular, how they can utilize parliamentary control in public finance management to foster democratic accountability, openness, and curbing corruption. I will also highlight how parliaments can strengthen their own internal mechanisms to curb corruption and maintain the credibility of parliament as an oversight body. I will articulate the linkages between the SADC public finance management model law and the SADC protocol against corruption, as well as other regional and international instruments on combating and preventing corruption, with a view to identify and pursue opportunities for parliamentary action in domestication at the national level. I will conclude by making some recommendations on priority areas for action by parliaments at national and regional level to strengthen the role of parliament in curbing corruption and promoting accountability in the SADC region. I will also include some collaborative actions. To begin with, looking at the prevalence of corruption. So corruption is probably as old as when organized society first established public institutions for its development and sustainability. You've heard it before today, and I'm sure at other forums, it is well recognized that corruption undermines democracy and impacts negatively on service delivery, on human and socio-economic development, on job creation, and on public trust in government, as well as on investor confidence in the region. From my work in the recent years, it has emerged, it appears from my research, that corruption has become fairly endemic in Southern Africa. And when corruption becomes endemic, for example, bribes, they lose much of their moral stigma in the eyes of those concerned. They blur the borderline between honesty and dishonesty, between truth and lies. And having grown into complex societies with a significantly sizable public sector, the opportunities for corruption to occur have certainly increased, and the types and nature of corruption have also evolved. So for our purposes today, we have to accept that corruption, governance, and politics are all intertwined, and that their relationship impacts on the fight to eradicate corruption. Again, from my research in the last few years, I have noted that countries in Southern Africa whose governance systems are genuinely anchored on the democratic foundations of rule of law and constitutionalism, buttressed by the principles of separation of powers that provides for independent functions of state organs, being the legislature, judiciary, and the executive, they tend to be more transparent and accountable and generally have lower levels of corruption. Obviously, where governance structures are weak, there is a tendency for less transparency and accountability. There is porous oversight, and ineffective law enforcement and judiciary systems. All this leads to higher incidences of corruption through the abuse of power and the looting of state resources by those in positions of authority. So a recent assessment of corruption in the SADC region focused on anti-corruption measures as regards seven areas. They focused on, you will see it on the slide, illicit financial flows, systems of government hiring and procurement of services, government revenue collection and control systems, whistleblowing mechanisms, money laundering, trafficking in persons, and asset recovery. What emerged from this assessment is that the common threads across all the seven focal areas addressed through this regional corruption assessment were, and again it's up on your screen, So firstly, the need for enhanced interagency cooperation domestically and within the region, especially in respect of illicit financial flows, trafficking in persons, and asset recovery. Another need was for capacity building, including technical expertise, infrastructure, and funding. And here it was especially in respect of, again, illicit financial flows and asset recovery. And the final main need was to strengthen legislation, which is not just the provisions of the legislation, but also its implementation, and to raise public awareness about it. And this was in particular identified in respect of whistleblowing provisions and trafficking in persons. However, there are other types of corruption prevalent in the Southern African landscape, which for our purposes today are very relevant to bear in mind at this meeting's deliberations. So, the first one deals with political integrity. So one of the foundations of our democratic institutions is the social contract between voters and elected representatives. Politicians are entrusted with power in order to represent the interests of the general public. So political integrity means that politicians act in the public interest rather than serving private interests. And the separation of public and private spheres is paramount in the exercise of political integrity. So politicians won't always make decisions which align with short-term preferences of everyone, but it does mean that they act in a way which is consistent with a set of moral or ethical principles and standards. So crucially, political corruption excludes and disenfranchises large swathes of the population, particularly those who are less well-connected and powerful. As I've mentioned before, corruption erodes citizens' trust in democratic institutions and leads to political apathy, which in turn fuels corruption. So open, fair, and accountable access to decision-making is essential to regain citizens' trust in democracy and to ensure that policies meet people's needs. Another type of corruption is state capture, which occurs when corruption is so systemic within the institutions of the state that private interests substitute their own interests for the common good as the main drivers of policy and regulation. When the state is captured, companies and individuals shape and affect the formulation of laws and regulations through illicit payments such as bribes to parliamentarians and public officials. Illicit contributions during electoral campaigns and influencing key public sector appointments are other methods that ultimately lead to an erosion of public trust in public institutions. Another type of corruption is conflicts of interest. This occurs when a person is in a position to derive personal benefit from actions or decisions made in their official capacity. And such situations risk placing the private interest of the political decision makers above the public interest. Another type of risk area is the political party funding. So a common avenue for money to enter politics, besides direct bribes paid to senior officials is through the financing of political parties. When elected, politicians can give preferential treatment to companies or groups who bankrolled their campaigns. And at the same time, when political contestants do not have to declare the sources of funding and campaign expenditure, the costs of election campaigns increase and the risk of illegal expenditure also increases, such as, for example, vote buying. Then we have abuse of state resources. This is also defined as undue advantages obtained by certain parties or candidates through use of their official positions or connections to government institutions to influence the outcome of elections. It's a grave breach of political integrity because it gives incumbents an unfair electoral advantage. Moving on to look at a conceptual framework for parliamentary action at national and the regional level. And also we're looking here at strategies that parliaments can use to combat corruption. I will also highlight how parliaments can strengthen their own internal mechanisms to curb corruption and maintain the credibility of parliament as an oversight body. So the best barrier against corruption is, I think, a well-functioning parliament. It must ensure transparency and accountability at all levels. For me, I see parliament as the link between government and civil society. I like to think of our parliamentarians like are like traffic wardens on a two-way street. So they must inform their electorate about parliamentary and government actions, and they must channel public requests in the opposite direction. The reasons why parliamentarians as individuals are so important is that they will only be able to require the personal integrity of others if their own is without blemish. Parliamentarians must therefore be completely open about the sources of their election funds, their personal assets and income, and from what sources these derive. Their position as mediators between civil society and the executive is crucial. So in adopting laws that protect civil liberties and secure freedom of information, or, for example, in drafting rules that protect those who denounce corruption, parliamentarians can create a context within which corruption cannot develop. And there are a number of key entry points to exercise this oversight function, including, for example, through questions to government, participation in the budget process, oversight committees, especially public account committees, cooperation with supreme audit institutions and other watchdog agencies. Contextual factors influencing the effectiveness of oversight include a relatively low level of partisanship at committee level, access to alternative sources of information, and the public demand for good governance. So in most countries, parliaments are empowered to approve the budget and oversee government expenditure through the four stages of the budget cycle, which is the drafting, the legislation, implementation, and audit. And this, for me, is one of the most powerful tools for holding government to account. And for Parliament to fulfill this mandate effectively, the process for preparing and executing the budget needs to be transparent, it needs to be participatory. It needs to provide safeguards against government misuse of public resources. However, what my research has revealed, especially in the SADC region, in many of our countries, given the overly technical nature of the budget process, the complex financial instruments used, and the time pressure, members of parliament often lack the resources and the technical capacity to fulfill this role effectively. So, the budgetary oversight skills and capacity of parliaments can be strengthened, I would suggest, by established, for example, special committees, such as your public account committee, and having these committees conduct public consultations in advance of the budget, and then to monitor implementation ex post facto. Parliaments can also cooperate with external oversight agencies, such as supreme audit institutions, your ombudsman, or anti-corruption agencies. And parliaments can play a strong role to promote the creation of strong watchdog agencies with adequate resources, and also to strengthen cooperation between and among parliaments. And these institutions to ensure that their reports receive adequate attention and that their recommendations are followed up by Parliament and government. So, electoral integrity. Electoral integrity refers to the appropriate conduct of all parties involved in elections, including candidates, voters, and election management authorities. As they represent citizens, members of parliament need to reflect the ethical standards of their community. They need to be exemplary in performing their mandate and adhere to the highest standards of integrity. This, for me, is a prerequisite for promoting or restoring trust in the institution. So this would necessitate strengthening the integrity of political parties, particularly during electoral competition for power, by, as I've mentioned before, regulating political party funding and campaign finance, as in many cases, parliamentarians are implicated in political corruption scandals involving, for example, the vote buying, contributions from illegal sources, and illegal use of state resources. So this would involve establishing ethical, an effective ethical regime for parliamentarians through the development and implementation of integrity laws and codes of ethics, regulations on conflicts of interest, asset declaration rules, and so forth, and also mechanisms to ensure effective implementation of these ethical rules. So while such codes of conduct are often poorly implemented, some studies have shown that they are perceived by parliaments as helpful in certain situations, such as, for example, preventing technical infringements, also protecting parliamentarians when dealing with constituents and subjecting them to greater scrutiny, both inside and outside the parliament. So factors that contribute to the effectiveness of the codes include the existence of broad support amongst parliamentarians, that members of parliament are involved in the development of the code. Another factor is the existence and nature of sanctions established for violating the code. And then the prevailing political culture is also relevant. And also what is important is training activities that are undertaken to raise awareness and build members of parliament's ethical skills. I'm moving on now to look at the links between the SADC public finance model, which Jay took you through in good detail this morning, and I'm also grateful for that. I appreciate the way he presented it. So we're looking at the linkages between that model law and various other international instruments, such as the SADC Protocol Against Corruption and other regional and international instruments. So as part of their legislative mandate, parliaments are responsible for ensuring that there is a strong legal framework in place to curb corruption. And this does not only involve passing national anti-corruption legislation that tackles corruption, but also to lobby national governments to ratify regional and international instruments that are relevant, which would be the SADC Protocol, the AU Convention on Preventing and Combating Corruption, and the United Nations Convention Against Corruption. So the SADC Protocol is an agreement which, as I recall, is an incarnation of regional efforts to collaboratively address the threat that corruption poses. It's a fairly old, it's one of the oldest instruments against corruption. It came into force in July of 2005, although it was drafted well before that. Excuse me. And the protocol provides a framework for regional cooperation, considering that corruption is very often essentially a transnational organized crime. Unfortunately, the protocol doesn't go into much detail as regards public finance management. So it just gives a broad basis on which the region can address corruption. But the AU Convention on Preventing and Combating Corruption, in its Article 4, it requires member states to adopt legislative and other measures that will create, maintain, and strengthen, for example, internal accounting, auditing, and follow-up systems, in particular in the public income, customs and tax receipts, expenditure, and procedures for hiring, procurement, and management of public goods and services. And this is relevant for the PFM model law. Article 7 of that convention also provides for the declaration of assets by public officials, and in subparagraph 4, it requires transparency, equity, and efficiency in managing the tendering or hiring procedures within the public service. And then Article 10 of that convention deals with the funding of political parties. So that's about as far as the AU convention goes in its relevance for our purposes today. The United Nations Convention, which is the international overarching instrument globally against corruption, I'm going to focus a little more on that because that is usually the yardstick against which countries benchmark their anti-corruption measures and status of their fight against corruption. So Article 1C of the, we call it the UNCAC, of UNCAC, aims to promote integrity, accountability, and proper management of public affairs and public property. And this, to a large degree, as Jay has already said, is mirrored and espoused in Part 2 of the SADC PFM model law, which deals with the aims and objectives of the law. Then Article 7 of the UNCAC requires the state parties to have criteria for the candidature and election to public office, and also to take measures, legislative and administrative measures, to enhance transparency in the funding of candidatures for elected public office, and where applicable, the funding of political parties. Conflict of interest is also addressed in the UN Convention Against Corruption. Article 7, paragraph 4, requires state parties to have systems that promote transparency and prevent conflicts of interest. And then in Article 8, subparagraph 5, it is stipulated that states' parties will establish measures that require public officials to make declarations to appropriate authorities regarding, for example, their outside activities, their employment, their investments, assets, and any substantial gifts or benefits from which a conflict of interest may result with respect to their functions as political, as public officials. The reason why I've mentioned all these articles, even though they don't relate directly to the PFM, is because they do relate to parliamentarians, and so they are relevant for this august body. But the more relevant article, insofar as the SADC PFM model law is concerned, is Article 9, which deals with of the UNCAC, which deals with public procurement and management of public finances. So the subparagraph 1 is, I've put it up on the screen, and it basically deals with that parties will establish systems of procurement which are based on transparency, that there should be competitive and objective criteria in decision-making, and that they must take into account appropriate threshold values in their application. It also deals, it gives certain examples, and they, you will see them on the slide above in paragraph 1, A to E, and these slides will be made available to you. So they basically set out various measures that can be adopted to bolster implementation of this provision. And then looking at subparagraph 2, here again, there are various measures that are enunciated within the convention, and to a large degree, they are mirrored within the SADC PFM model. For example, procedures for the adoption of the national budget. This is included in part 7 of the SADC PFM model law, which is entitled National Budget. Then the UNCAC requires timely reporting on revenue and expenditure, and here we are covered in part 10 of the SADC PFM model law, which deals with public accounts. Then paragraph C deals with a system of accounting and auditing standards and related oversight, and here again we are covered in part 6 of the SADC PFM model law, which is entitled Parliamentary Control. And then D of this provision deals with effective and efficient systems of risk management and internal control. Here, again, part 3 of the SADC PFM model law deals with this under the heading Authorities, General Functions of the Finance Secretary and Accounting of, Officers. And then finally, the UNCAC says where appropriate, there must be corrective action in the case of failure to comply with the requirements. And here, part 11, which deals with financial misconduct, misuse, and maladministration. And I think Jay did a good job of going into that in more detail on what the nature of the misuse can be. So you will see that it is quite patent from this comparison that the SADC public finance management model law goes well beyond the clauses of the UNCAC and other regional multilateral legal instruments that have been ratified by the SADC states. And almost all SADC states have ratified, if not have acceded to, if not ratified, the UNCAC. I think there are two that have not, if my memory serves me well. Then moving on to recommendations, and here we're also looking at some priority areas for action by parliaments at a national and a regional level. And the thrust of my presentation today is to submit that parliaments, as the primary expression of the people's will, also have a primary duty to fight corruption. So there are many actors involved in parliamentary strengthening programs, which typically can involve support for institutional reform and development, skills transfer and capacity building, human support services, and support to peer networks of parliamentarians, such as this forum. One of the most important lessons that emerged from the literature that I reviewed in preparation for today's engagement is that due to their inherently political nature, parliamentary strengthening interventions need to be neutral, country-specific, and based on a solid understanding of the political economy and to be informed by local needs assessment. And I'm going to suggest a series of measures, which include transparency in the funding of political parties and election campaigns, a code of conduct for members of parliament, and close scrutiny of their sources of income and possible conflicts of interest. These are the ones we all know. But more specifically, I would propose that high-ranking politicians and public servants should regularly and publicly disclose their financial assets as well as their business interests, that political parties and contestants should disclose sources of funding as well as the destination of expenditure, that private companies donating to political candidates should disclose their true owners, that election oversight bodies and other agencies tasked with monitoring undue influence of money in politics should be given the independence, mandate, and resources to meaningfully conduct their activities. And then also civil society and the media needs to be empowered to monitor campaign expenditure, lobbying activities, and the abuse of state resources around election campaigns. In order to successfully fight corruption, parliaments in their capacity as a country's supreme political authority and instance of control should, where applicable, ensure that state institutions, including parliaments themselves, are so transparent and accountable as to be able to withstand corruption or to permit its rapid exposure. So what needs to be done is to instill in parliament's own ranks the notion that parliamentarians have a duty not only to obey the letter of the law, but to set an example of incorruptibility to society as a whole by implementing and enforcing their own codes of conduct. We need to introduce an annual system for the establishment of assets of parliamentarian and close associates. We need to create clear and fair legislation, including efficient public supervision as regards the funding of political parties and election campaigns. And here again, I'm repeating myself, but the proper declaration of sources of income and of potential conflicts of interest is very important in this regard. We also need to safeguard the strength of civil liberties, as I've mentioned, including press freedom, and the ability of citizens to form associations for informing the public, including, for example, through freedom of information legislation. The independence of the judiciary and the media must be protective. And then all public expenditure, revenue collection, and public procurement has to be checked either by an independent auditing body or, where necessary, for state security or other reasons, by a competent parliamentary instance. Another recommendation is to take special measures to protect the position and career prospects of whistleblowers. That is to say, officials who unmask and report cases of corruption, and establish, where this has not yet been done, a code of conduct for civil servants and political officials. Then another recommendation is to enact legislation which provides for adequate and precise sanctions against those who engage in corruption. And as far as possible, we also need to simplify regulations, permits, administrative procedures, and the like, since these are often they often open up possibilities to exact or to receive bribes. Then another problem that has emerged in the region which needs to be addressed is the appointment of underqualified public officials. So in my research, in researching state capture in the region, what emerged is that often public officials are appointed with inadequate qualifications. So those who are competent are often pressurized to neglect their duties, and this further enables the appointment of people without the necessary skills and discipline to perform their duties. And here, what I would recommend is that Parliament should consider opening up debate on the desirability or feasibility, of a system that incorporates public participation and parliamentary oversight for certain categories of appointments to public office, to increase independence and accountability, and to achieve the objectives of a capable developmental state. Then there is the misuse of discretionary powers. It's another sign of a corrupt activity. I think somebody mentioned it earlier on today in the discussions, the use of alternative procurement processes or retrospective authorizations, which are allowed in specific scenarios. These are sometimes referred to as deviations and expansions, and they often involve exemptions in expenditure ceilings, the bypassing of regular procurement policies, requirements, and or undue involvement of political heads in the procurement process. And here, what we would want to look at is to amend the law to disallow excessive individual discretionary powers. So committees need to fiercely challenge the decisions of ministers or empowered officials when their actions do not represent the public interest. And discretion should be discouraged if it undermines transparency, public participation, or due process. So in conclusion, so for me, a parliament is a country's central institution in its capacity as the primary expression of the people's will, and it therefore has a paramount responsibility for combating corruption in all its forms, especially in public life. But increasingly also in the economy at large. So parliaments must undertake this task for the general morality of society, but also for its lasting economic progress, which vitally depends on honesty and trust. And as Southern Africa and you know, the world at large comes together, the struggle becomes more complex and urgent. So the SADC and national parliaments must be, for me, in the forefront of promoting good governance in Southern Africa and of raising awareness of the dangers of corruption. And the fight against corruption is rendered all the more difficult as economic competition between countries, companies, and groups of countries intensifies. You know, there's the field of industrial espionage. The sums involved increase along with the size of the deals. And so public morals may loosen. And if parliaments, as the last bastion against corruption, are themselves affected by it, then the battle may well be lost. So therefore, I trust that the implementation of the interventions I have proposed today will augur well for the future successes of this august and austere body. And I wish you well in your further deliberations. Please feel free to engage with me. I'm just going to check the chat group, and you're welcome to make your comments. Thank you.
Muito obrigada. Passamos em seguida a convidar.
We are going on to ask Mr. Titus to also make the presentation. So it is Mr. Titus. Mr. Titus Huemende, you can take the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam President, and thank you, honorable members. I want to thank you for this opportunity to come and share briefly some thoughts on corruption and public financial management. Perhaps I will start with a short story that some of you may know. I noticed there are some honorable members here that I haven't met, so perhaps they have not heard the story. Stories have talked about two Southeast Asian political leader invited his African friend for dinner at his house. On their way from the airport to his house, the road to the house was beautiful. You know, the lights, you know, the trees, the shopping complexes. By the time they got to the house, it was a palace, marble, imported from Italy, beautiful double-story building. So they were on the top floor of that mansion smoking cigars. And the African friend asks his Southeast Asian friend and says, how did you make it? You know, this is such a beautiful house, man. Beautiful infrastructure, everything. How did you make it? So the Southeast Asian man says, you know, my friend, you look at that house, you look at that road. He says, which road? And he showed this beautiful road they were traveling on. He says, I got 10%. And then he says, do you look at that shopping mall? He showed him the shopping mall they passed through. I got 10%. He said, This is how you build this very beautiful house. He said, yes, 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 my friend, this is our quarter. He continued having dinner and, of course, later on. A year later, the African friend invites his Southeast Asian man to his house. On the way from the airport, you know, they passed through a road. Really ramshackled, you know, a dead road. There was no tar. The lights were not working. By the time they got to the house now, the house was four stories. Beautiful building. Eh? They got on top. The man also built his own veranda on top, a nice balcony. Then they are talking now. He says, your turn. You were wondering about my double story, your four story. How did you build this, my friend? He says, you see that third road? He says, I don't see the third road. What do you mean? He says, yeah, yeah, that third road. 100%. Eh? I got 100%. He says, so that's how you build houses. How about the shopping mall? You see that shopping mall coming from the east? He says, there's no shopping mall. He says, 100%. This is the story of these two people. I'm not telling you the countries, but it happened at some point. I'm making this story, or I'm sharing this story, and I want you to remember, these honorable members, as I finish my presentation, or as I start my presentation, I want you to remember just the morale of the story. And it will make sense as I present. Now, I won't talk so much about the technical issues of PFM, because I think the advocate has been quite erudite. Jay has been very erudite as well about just the provisions of PFM itself. What I want to do is try and situate the PFM debates within the context of African countries that are trying to grow their economies, and then the paradoxes that we have seen in growth, inequality, and rise of corruption. And what I can share to you is I'm going to give the example of China. For one reason, I think it is on course to be the world's biggest economy. It is one of the countries that a lot of African countries are relating and trading and looking up to. And the third reason is it has also had issues with corruption, growth, and population exposure. And so if you understand China and corruption, I think we'll understand a lot of things about how we can move forward as a continent. So I will share brief lessons on China and how it is dealt with corruption. Then, of course, back home, trying to apply that to the African experience and conclude naturally with your role as legislators. I hope that is quite clear. Now, I've removed some slides because I think it would be repetition. And so I'll go straight in and talk about four domains of corruption. I borrowed heavily from the research of Professor Mushtaq Khan and Professor Yuen-Wen Ang, who are brilliant anti-corruption scholars. I would say they are probably, in my opinion, the leading scholars on anti-corruption in the world right now, and they're from Global South. Professor Ang divides domains of corruption into four. In other words, there are essentially four types of corruption that we need to think through as we, grapple with public financial management. Four types. And these four types are basically drugs. They operate like drugs, and you know how different drugs work. And the first type of corruption is petty theft. The second one is grand theft. The third one is speed money. The fourth one is called access money. Now, I'm going to explain. Petty theft refers to acts of stealing, misuse of public funds, or extortion among street-level bureaucrats. You know, those street-level bureaucrats, your police, you know, your land officer, lower level, but bureaucrats. You know, they ask small money, $30 to do this, you want to cut a line, you want to get a pass, you know, but there's nothing petty about corruption. But it is categorized as petty corruption for street-level bureaucrats. The second one is grand theft. It refers to embezzlement or misappropriation of large sums of public monies by political elites. This is where $100 million, which is meant to build a highway, disappears, and you get 100%. That is grand theft. It actually never happens. The money disappears into the thin air, and no one can explain to the auditor general where that money went. The third one is speed money. It means petty bribes that businesses and citizens pay to bureaucrats to get around hurdles. So you want a passport in your country, and it's difficult to get a passport. So you pay $100 so that you get a passport quickly. That is speed money. It is corruption, but it's a different kind of corruption called speed money. Access money, and I want us to remember this because I think this is one way of understanding what is happening in other countries, which is access money. It encompasses high-stakes rewards extended by business actors to political officials, not just for speed, but for access to exclusive valuable privileges. In other words, you're looking at bribes. So you want an oil block in North Mozambique, in Palma, and so because you want gas, you pay maybe 50 million so that you are given rights to explore for gas in that area. You get the block, you start producing gas, you start making money and stuff like that. So this is large money, but it is access money. This is what eventually leads to state capture. Now, the example of this, these are all in the public domain. Jiji Yang, former party secretary Yang Zhu, this was disclosed by the Chinese government. He received hefty halves, bribes, company shares, because he was getting bribes for companies that were giving, who were getting contracts for different things. And he got six. He got arrested and, of course, got in jail. The interesting thing is in that province, which is Nianjing, where he was leading, Nianjing's profits multiplied 15-fold through this guy who was provincial secretary. So these are the four domains. What do we learn from these four domains? I think the first one is corruption is never good. I think from the start, I think I want to be very categorical. Corruption is not good, and not all forms of corruption are equally bad for the economy. Nor does it cause the same kind of harm. You know, part of the missing link in current anti-corruption work is we bunch corruption the same. It's all corruption, which is true. It is all harmful, which is true, but it's harmful in different ways. We gave the analogy of drugs. You know, they are painkillers. Painkillers are different from steroids. Steroids are harmful, and I think we can all agree. But you go to the gym, you use steroids, what happens? You can pump up your muscles for a few months or even years. We know this, those who go to the gym. And you can even win a competition because you're looking strong and pumped up. But of course, 3 years down the line, you can have a heart attack and die because steroids are never good for your health. But in the short term, people will not see, because your muscles are going up. So the truth of the matter is, steroids can actually help in the short term, but they are harmful in the long term. Same thing with toxic drugs. You use them, some of them can kill you immediately. Some of them are like painkillers. They take away the pain, but they don't address the root issues. So they are all drugs, but they work differently. And why we need to understand this is, I think it will help us focus as African countries. Which forms of corruption should we focus on? Which forms are most damaging? Because while we can all be considered corrupt, you know, you talk to people, African countries are corrupt, there's no country where you will not find corruption. But what you will see is different countries have different forms of corruption. And because of that, the corruption in your country then affects your country differently. And that's a crucial way, especially when you think of how do we respond to that. Now, so that's a key lesson. They don't cause the same kind of harm. Second, the rise of capitalism is accompanied not by eradication of corruption, but rather by the evolution of the quality of corruption, from downright thuggery and theft to influence peddling. So what you're seeing in countries is that people say, I know these ones are not corrupt. The truth is, it's quality of corruption. And corruption evolves through the system that you have. You now have in countries where it's no longer downright theft, where 100 billion disappears into the thin air. No. You call it lobbying. In the States, it's actually called lobbying. And you can actually move around with a name tag called lobbying. Here, lobbying would consider it state capture. But in some countries, it's actually nice. You can do it with a nice tie. So corruption evolves in quality and form and in name in other countries. And you can get to a point where it's actually not considered corruption. I think until 10, 15 years ago, in the U.S., insider trading was not considered wrong. Here, insider trading has always been wrong. So it's different in terms of quality, kind, and how it evolves in every space. Back to China. And I was saying, I think we want to use the Chinese example and understand the basic things. So from the first start, people should be skeptical about any argument that hails or bashes China. So I'm not here to hail China as some golden country or to bash it as some hopeless country. No, this is not. I like nuance. And I like to engage in complexity and the paradoxes. And paradoxes essentially are the most consistent trait in reform-era Chinese political economy. And we need to grab and unpack that. Understanding it requires that we underscore and grasp these paradoxes. And what is the paradox? And this is the starting point. That what is truly extraordinary about China is that no country with the same risk profile or corruption risk profile has come anywhere close to reaching the scale of economic expansion. And this is the question that a lot of us in the development field have refused to explain, is how is it possible that a country has grown to the extent where over 700 people have moved out of poverty in a generation? And yet when you look at the corruption performance of China in almost any index, China is actually considered one of the more corrupt countries. But we've been told that, you know, corruption lowers investment, corruption you reduce your growth, and yet we have not explained why a country which is on track to be the superpower has grown rapidly while corruption has also grown. And this is the paradox that we need to unpack so that we know how to address what's happening in our own country. And in cracking the paradox, I think we need to understand that first point, that not all corruption is equally damaging. Indeed, certain kinds of corruption may stimulate growth in short term, yet produce serious risks and distortions. You remember, this one says I got 10%, this one got 100%. You are both very corrupt, but corrupt in different ways and forms. Now, I want to give, sorry, it's not very clear, this picture, but I hope I can explain. You will get the presentation. What you will see in China is actually quite fascinating. I want you to look at the years from 1998 to 2014. And I see you see a paradox there. Exchange, which I talked about, access money, which is an exchange of money between elites, you know, a business and a bureaucrat. It actually has gone up, if you see, on the access. But when you look at downright theft and embezzlement, it has gone down sharply. I don't know if you notice the difference, which is weird. They are all supposed to go. Right? What you notice in certain countries, certain types of corruption have been arrested, whereas other forms of corruption haven't. What you see in countries that are growing is they have arrested the most damaging forms of corruption in their country, which is my main message to you as legislators. You are actually not going to be able to eradicate corruption, because corruption, capitalism, competition, scarcity, are going to be here until kingdom come. What you can do is to arrest certain types that are more damaging to growth, development, and inequality, and then find a way of dealing with others that you can't. That's why you notice that in countries like China, while China may not do well in terms of anti-corruption indices, what China has done is to arrest the more damaging one, which is the most damaging one, is downright embezzlement. It is theft. Yet, exchange is gone up. Why is exchange gone up? Because private exchanges between elites is what is called access money. And access money, we understand it as private business. I know a lot of honorable members here are business people. How did you get the contract you got? Some of you will be honest and tell me that maybe you paid 15,000 bribe to get a certain exclusive rights. So what happens is you pay bribes, and in the short term you then deliver the service. And the economy can actually grow. This is what has happened in these countries, where capitalists and government officials have colluded with each other and given each other exchanges. So the capitalists get the license, the bureaucrats get the bribe, and the product is delivered. What then happens in the short term, you actually see massive rights. And I dare you that what you're also seeing on the current continent at the moment are nice roads, nice hospitals, nice railways. But if you want to be honest, a lot of these railways, a lot of these hospitals, there was access money involved. Eh? So the thing was produced. Eh? The hospital was built. The railway line was built. But there was access money involved. Someone paid to get exclusive rights. And the product still happened. That is corruption, but a different kind of corruption. And that kind of corruption in the short term in some countries, in fact, in all countries in transition, and there is data to prove this, countries in transition, they can actually have a lot of this. Look at access money and grand theft. This is the same China. Eh? Bribery is going up, which is access money. Embezzlement is going down. Misappropriation is going down. In other words, they are dealing with those who are just waking up tomorrow, going to work. Allocation for health, 1 billion, 900 million disappears. Those firms in a lot of the advanced economies, they've gotten away with it. Which is why for Africa, we have to really deal. You looked at Jay, the advocate, just spoke about illicit financial flows. Part of the reason why we have to address illicit financial flows is you are looking at 50 billion worth of African sweat disappearing from African coffers out of the continent completely. That is one of the most damaging kinds of corruption. You cannot compare that kind of corruption with greasing a politician so that you build a hospital, which you in fact built. That is corruption, but a different kind of corruption. This is what science says. So it says you have to arrest misappropriation, embezzlement, and you have to see that if you don't deal with access money in the long term, you're going to have an economic heart attack, which is what you're seeing now in certain aspects. I'm sure you've read Chinese reports where there is now overinvestment. You see, because what happens when you're paying bribes to bureaucrats, they keep giving you licenses. Eh? And you get to a point where you overinvest in an area. And you're investing not because you need the investment. You are investing because someone is getting a bribe. So there is what is now called overinvestment is in economic terms. And you have a real estate bubble where you're having buildings without tenants, buildings that can't be claimed. Buildings were built because there was a company that was producing cement. It paid bribes to sell the cement. A building that was never necessary ended up being built. So you end up having a real estate bubble. So of course, to eventually catch up with you. But in the short term, people will see nice new things, people will see an economy flourishing and stuff like that. So see what you can arrest. Now, what's happening now with my... Oh, zoom it off. Okay. Right, so explaining Chinese paradox. So let's explain now. The first thing to I think explain what was happening, why is China has grown, why is China growth been rapid, 10%, in some cases five for decades, not just for 5 years, but for decades, yet corruption has gone up, is number one. The dominant type of corruption in China is access money, which has stimulated growth. And this is, and I hope, I mean, there are people are not going to misquote me and say he was actually saying be corrupt to stimulate growth. No. It did stimulate growth, but it did generate distortions and risks in the economy. Like I say, you can do good and bad at the same time, like steroids. You can have the bulging muscles, but beware of a heart attack. So the huge risk is the heart failure. Heart failure is the economic crash. Some of you who are China experts will know all the economic crashes that have happened. But the biggest economic crash was 2008, the global financial crisis. What that was steroids in manifestation. Banks borrowing, countries and stuff like that. And it got to a point where the steroids led to the heart attack. That is what happens with access money. Stock market booms. You know, share buybacks, stock prices going up. But at some point, there is a crash. So smart countries should know the point at which you have reached the tipping point, which is where China is. And I will give you an example of how that happens. The second explanation is access money dominates because the Chinese political system runs on profit sharing. And there is a historical context in this. You remember in the late 70s when Chairman Deng Xiaoping, he was transitioning the economy from being socialist under Chairman Mao, to a market economy. He needed to get the elites within China to accept. And the best way to accept was he had to bring them in and ensure that everyone has an interest in that. So access money began to fly as a way of ensuring that comrades do not resist a market economy. Now, I'm not saying this is good, I'm giving you a historical fact of what happened. So this is what led to the rise of access money in China. It was a way of ensuring that comrades don't resist the market economy that was coming in China. And so because comrades were getting their own fair share, if you go to Nanjing, you get your check. You go to Shenzhen, if you are a governor, you get your 10%. It was not difficult for people to accept a market economy. It was not an ideological consensus where everyone set up and say, comrades are over. No. They were getting access money. So access money functions as an incentive system for politicians and capitalists to work together. This is what is making, these teas you are seeing in five-star hotels between a politician and an investor. It's not a love for country or access money for a lot of them. They went together, especially on massive infrastructure, huge sunk costs, and you are seeing all these express highways in Africa. Sometimes a bridge to nowhere. You're asking citizens, where is this bridge going? It's a nice bridge that was built and it's not going anywhere. There was access money involved. And so what access money is, it overpays the capitalists to do some things through cheap loan subsidies, state backing, and in return you can get feverish growth for a short time, which leaves 700 million out of poverty. But what then happened is in the late 90s there was a crash. So you will notice that in China from the 2000s, capacity building reforms, which were of the PFM type, and severe punishment is what arrested the problem. This is where this meeting is important. Because what then happened was, as stock markets were rising, buildings happening, railways, I think in China it was 10,000 kilometers of tarred road which was being constructed every year. The amount of cement which is used in China in 1 year is larger than the amount of cement that has been used in America for the last 200 years. You're talking about crazy expansion. But what then happened, it got to a point where it reached the head start. And so what happened is around 1998, huge people like Premier Zhu Rongji, who was a massive bureaucrat, you know, they introduced all kinds of laws, PFM laws that I'll explain later. Punishments about 1.5 million bureaucrats. I'm talking about bureaucrats alone who were punished because of corruption when things got to a point. When things got to a point of a head start. Explaining the paradox. The third one, the most severe forms of corruption like grand theft, speed money were brought under control through an ambitious program of capacity building. This started around 1998. So you need bureaucrats like Premier Zhu Rongji, legislators who rise like a phoenix from the ages to say, this must stop in our country. And so they passed a civil service law, standardized tax rates, strengthening oversight through budgeting, accounting reforms, replacing cash payments of fees and fines with direct electronic deposits. You see me reading, a lot of this is actually boring. It's unsensational and it's very dry. You listen to a lot of discussions around PFM. No one likes to discuss PFM. Let's make things digital. It is small things like those that arrested the rot. Not much media covered a lot of this because this is boring stuff. But this is what legislators need to do. Invest in solid PFM to arrest the most damaging forms of graft. Consolidate, and you need bureaucrats who are going to do this. Now, these PFMs may not sound as exciting, but they have remarkably helped China to keep the most damaging forms of corruption under control. Now, this is a fact. Now, let's come back home. I was talking about the type of corruption. Where are we on the continent? 50 billion illicit financial flows out of Africa. It just disappears. You create money with your own sweat, it leaves the economy. That is a unique kind of corruption that you find in our space. You don't find a lot of countries where you create money. Even if that money is stolen, it still circulates in that economy. In this motherland, we don't just create. We create through the sweat of women and young people in rural areas. That money is earned. It disappears into the shores of Luxembourg, Guernsey, Jersey, Manila, where people are not working hard. They are staying in yachts and things like that. So this is the most damaging kind of corruption. Gold, diamond smuggling. Some of you who live on borders, you know what is going on. It's heart-rending. It's heart-rending. People are caught with 5 kgs of gold, 20 kgs of gold. We have dark, unknown airstrips in our countries. In at least every African country is an unknown airstrip in at least one province. No one knows about it. That airstrip is about smuggling some of the most precious minerals in that country. These are the most damaging forms of corruption here. Theft of COVID humanitarian relief, you remember. A country receives $200 million, that $200 million disappears into thin air. Empty coffers at inauguration. It's almost hilarious, eh? When in a new African country, the new African president comes, he finds nothing. So this is not access money where I pay a bribe to build a road. No, money disappears into the thin air. fetishization of externalization, where now we also now have the middle class. They earn money as medical doctors operating people's heads in Kakamega in Kenya, and they use the proceeds of that money to build their house in London. I mean, go to London right now. I mean, the real estate boom in London is driven by African money, Russian money, Asian money. It is created on the continent that goes there. So this is what is happening. What am I trying to say? I'm saying the kind of corruption that we have is the more damaged type. It has no short-term growth. It's not a steroid. It is cocaine. No benefit whatsoever, and the damages are immediate. And that's what we need to address. Eh? And I hope you can see the difference. Anyway, there is a lot happening on the tech space. I won't talk about this because the PSM talks about this. I think there is a big development with artificial intelligence where you can now project or speculate, not just speculate, but you can do sophisticated algorithms to know behavior that is potentially corrupt. You know before the corrupt person becomes corrupt that they are going to be corrupt. So artificial intelligence can also be used as an anti-corruption tool, crypto, I mean, you've covered this, so I won't belabor. State capture. The reason why state capture becomes a problem in our space is in countries like China, the state becomes the dominating force. Whereas in our space, a politician becomes captured completely. Eh? Where a company writes laws. You know, there's a time where you are in a country where, yes, the politicians are receiving bribes, but they are still the ones in authority. In our space, the politicians become captured. In other words, they manifest the interests of private interests, which is normally a multinational corporation. And a lot of this is a function of our structure. So we've got a country which has a GDP of $15 billion. And companies that are operating in that country have a market capitalization of $200 billion. Eh? So you have a $200 billion company operating in a $15 billion GDP economy. Good luck negotiating laws with such a company. So what then happens is this politician is just overwhelmed with a nice check that they can't refuse. And you get to a point where petroleum laws, good luck if you wrote your petroleum laws with your own legislators. Bills are passing through parliament. Eh? They say they pass through parliament. They are not passed by parliament, but they are passing through parliament. They are already written. Not even by politicians, but by secretary and some of the large companies. So a lot of what we are also saying is, do we need some of the sizes of companies that we have? Or we need to grow them. And as the state matures, you also grow with those companies. So state capture is one of the more damaging. Opaque political financing, it goes hand in hand. Land corruption, you have entire provinces that are now owned by individuals who are foreign. And usually Caucasian and European or, you know, Anglo-Saxon, an entire province. The most fertile land in much of Africa is not owned by Africans or people who live in that place. So when you engage in those kinds of corruption, you can't recover in most of the cases. Private investors are engaged in corrupt deals to access land and to bypass consultants. Consultants with that. Now, extractive industry, which is my area of expertise, this is how we start having to address some of these things. How do you deal with this if you are a small economy engaging with big companies? Don't negotiate in private. Because you can't possibly win. We're talking about Twitter right now or Tesla. I mean, look at the market capitalization of Tesla. They bring lawyers, your principal director in the minister's office, whose salary is $500 US equivalent, is doing private negotiations. It's never going to work. So you want open bidding and licensing to address some of this. Illicit financial flows, I keep mentioning, because they are the more damaging type, because they take money out of circulation. That's number one. Number two, they are enriching countries that will then go to beg for loans. Eh? Because what is happening in illicit financial flows, I'll tell you which is where the enabling part is, and this is where it annoys me. So a politician B, let's call him Mr. Kivuku. He opens an account in London, 500 million. The bank is very nice to him, gives him nice coffee. 3 years down the line, that account is seized. For the next 10 years, those accounts are seized. 500 million. They are frozen in a European bank for 10 years. What is happening with that 500 million, those 10 years? Officially, we are told it is actually seized, it is frozen. But the truth is, it is on a certain bank's balance sheet being used. And so this is the game that is happening. You are lured. They know you are corrupt. They lure you to open an account. A few years after enjoying some coffee, your accounts are frozen. And for 15 years, you can't access that. And that money is being played with on the markets and enriching banks. My view is, next time an African leader's account has been frozen, there has to be a third-party escrow account where that money is moved, so that that bank does not benefit. Because what you're having is banks, international banks, that are benefiting from frozen money. If it is corrupt money, then you shouldn't have it in your own account, and you must be punished for that, especially if a determination has been made that that money was not corrupt. But what you have is you have money for like Duvalier, Gaddafi, who were told all these guys corrupt. But the money is still frozen in Anglo-Saxon banks as we speak. So there are different types of harm that comes with this financial flows that we are enriching countries where we're looking for loans. Number two is we are taking money out of circulation in our economy, which is pre-source curse. Pre-source curse is how politicians go on a spending rampage when they hear that they are about to strike gold, oil, or gas. So now it is when you're told that country X is about to discover gas. You look at how they borrow. It's called the pre-source curse. You become excited for something that you don't even have. So the unique vulnerability of the sector to rampant corruption on the continent is such that you have to pay particular attention on PFM for extractives. Artisanal small-scale mining, as you all know, it's very difficult to move gold. It's very easy to move diamonds. It's very easy to move. So it's easy for corruption to happen in that. Now, quickly, as I rush through the role of parliament, I won't repeat physician, heal thyself. Speaking about parliament itself, the need to resist capture. The advocate has spoken on that. And still parliament's own ranks, the notion that parliaments should have a duty not only to pay, but to set an example. Let me not get too bogged down on it because it has been eloquently mentioned. The last two or three slides. Now, engage the ideological underpinnings of law and policy. And this is something that we often overlook. All governance approaches are laden with ideological and cultural assumptions about development. And now, right now, we're talking about all kinds of laws. We must do this, UNCAC, ANCAC, and I'm going to talk about that. But the truth of all these approaches are value-laden. And they are laden with ideological and cultural assumptions about development that we need to unpack before we pass these laws. Questions of corruption and inequality cannot be separated from the economic system at play in a given domain. And as such, legislators must question models of growth that are in the region. I will tell you, a lot of us are implementing staff monitored program by IMF. We all know that. Usually to pass, and I'll give you the West African example. You remember some of the countries that were vulnerable to Ebola or countries that suffered because of Ebola had passed a staff monitored program by IMF. You remember that? Eh? They were actually said, you have passed. Eh? Passing meant containing the wage bill. Containing the wage bill meant cutting salaries of senior physicians, reducing the number of nurses, yada, yada, yada. IMF looked at this and said, you are financially prudent. You have passed your S&P. Eh? A few months down the line, Ebola strikes. People are saying, why are these Africans dying? They are not responding. The state capacity had been decapitated and dismembered, and it had no capacity then to respond to disaster. So when we pass certain laws, certain debt assumption bills, certain containments of wage bills, we're actually speaking of a certain ideological position on the role of the state and the responsibility of the state to the citizen. So I'm saying when we pass laws, we must think through the value that they project. And we have to think through the growth. When a minister is coming and posts about 7% growth, next time one legislator do unpack that growth. UNDP did the research in 1996, which cautioned against ruthless growth, which leaves women and young people, movements, and rural areas behind. You have seen the growth that we're seeing on the continent. Is the metropolis the one that is growing? Tall buildings in the top capital city. Now with Ebola, with the COVID, no one is using those buildings. Conference centers, stadiums. Go to the third, fourth largest city. There is nothing going on. It's ruthless. 7% growth concentrated in the first and second capital city. Ruthless growth which overlooks African agents. So of course you grew 10% based on an economic policy that you got from McKinsey or some other intellectual, jobless growth, which usually comes with extractive. You know, a typical gas LNG plant, I love Maputo, so I love using the Maputo example. The LNG plant in Maputo is going to employ only 200 people at full strength. So anyone who is expecting jobs is not going to get jobs because LNG jobs are not many. The only jobs you can expect are going to be maybe multiplier feeder industries. But otherwise, jobs from oil and gas aren't many. And so a lot of the growth tends to be jobless. So we want to interrogate when we come, we have these blueprints, because what then happens is we're having growth rising, inequality rising, and when growth and inequality rise, corruption becomes inevitable. In fact, corruption becomes imperative. You lose the capacity to not be corrupt. So sometimes when we sit here and say corruption is bad, I'm like, I don't even have the capacity to not be corrupt. That happens when inequality has become very, very high. So what kind of African states do we want? And for me, this is a critical question. I mean, beyond the PLFM that we want, beyond the public financial management, because you can come up with all the acts. The question is, what kind of state are we trying to construct? For me, that state should be capable. Should have enough nurses, should have enough doctors. And any economic blueprint, any debt package, any economic adjustment program that says you must reduce the number of doctors, nurses, teachers, we have to...
Disculpe,
our presenter only has 5 minutes left. You've gone over your time. 3 minutes, because you've gone over time already.
Citizenship. Agency. First exit, I think, is how we bring people into the conversation, is to demonstrate that there is no reason to expect corrupt officials and political leaders to reform themselves. So legislators, beyond crafting laws, we want to engage and mobilize our own constituents so that they are part of this. And historically, this usually becomes quite possible when per capita reaches 8,000 to about 10,000. Usually that's where you have constituents that are strong enough to challenge different sectors. This is actually a historical fact that before you reach 8,000 to 10,000, it is much harder to mobilize certain constituencies. I will pass through this one because I think we've talked about the model law, UNCAC, Africa Mining Vision, Sub-Regional Mining Vision, and that. So in conclusion, this is my last slide. The fight against corruption cannot be decoupled from the economic system a chosen country has chosen to implement. When your growth causes inequality, corruption will always be an issue. You can pass your anti-corruption commission, you can have a strong ombudsman, you can have your PLFM, but if the economic system is exclusionary, corruption will always be rampant. External stimuli, the corrupting role of big corporations, misguided policies and nations, which complicates domestication of efforts to deal with corruption. The third, empowered people can create change and force accountability. And my last point, all corruption erodes confidence in development, yet corruption harms differently. Countries must be circumspect in prioritizing the more damaging steroids, toxic drugs in our politics. Muito obrigado. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much. Thank you to the two presenters for their presentation that were very instructive and laden with a lot of content. Thank you very much. Now we are gone to the colleagues. Let's... We are going to debate the two presentations. Let's do that simultaneously. Three questions. Let's give our presenters the opportunity to say something so that they don't get lost.
Vamos, quem põe gado nisso? Isso. Zâmbia, por favor.
Zâmbia.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. Madam Chairperson, I want to go back to our mother who was just presenting. I want to get a clarification if he's able to avail before this committee on his last statement where he talked about public participation and parliamentary oversight for certain categories of appointments to public office. Madam Chairperson, this topic is very close to my chest because I've taken note that in most African countries, appointments to public offices are mishandled, and perhaps this has been a cause as to why we are not able to manage our economies, because in certain areas we make appointments based on friendship, relationship, tribesmen, and such things. So what I want to hear from her, whether there's a category of office bearers she thinks these must pass through public participation and parliamentary oversight. And secondly, Madam Chairperson, to the two speakers, what I want to know whether they are able to share the whole document with this committee via email or printing a hard copy, because these two presentations are such critical to this committee to see how SADC countries can improve. I submit, Madam Chairperson.
Obrigado, Zâmbia.
Thank you, Zâmbia.
Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I want to thank the two presenters for their quite informative presentations. My question to the last presenter is on minimizing corruption. So he says, since we can't eradicate corruption, there was mention on parliamentarians enacting laws. But my question to him is, there are jurisdictions where the laws are there, but the corruption still exists. Why is there no mention of other institutions that have to be strengthened in cases where all the laws are in place and corruption continues? I thank you.
Obrigado, Zimbabwe.
Thank you, Zimbabwe.
Namibia.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I would first like to want to thank the presenters for really giving such a robust and insightful discussion, especially explaining the different types of corruption and the effects that they have. I have my question to the first speaker, where she spoke about the parliamentary procedures in terms of holding the relevant executives accountable. She stated that we should write questions, oral questions, drafted questions, etc. But I just wanted to ask, in the case of where we do that, but then sometimes it's very difficult to get an answer from the specific minister. For instance, if you have a structural question or oral question on some deal that has gone, that is very shady, the minister normally starts acting in rhetorics. So how do we then, what would you recommend that we would use in terms of how holding the minister further accountable? Because if they are not accountable to parliament, what can you say? And I know obviously that due to different jurisdictions and the laws within different jurisdictions, they deal with that case differently. But what is the general view that we can have in terms of penalties in parliament that we can implement to ensure that ministers who avoid questions, ministers who avoid answering specific illicit deals, and also with the role of the Auditor General. That was something I also saw in the model law that I thought it was very radical, and it was really good to ensure that every report that is brought to Parliament in terms of even those that are alleged should be clarified. But what happens in Parliament is when corruption cases and money that's missing comes to Parliament, there is no feedback in terms of them even clarifying some of these allegations that are made by members of Parliament to ensure that the public is informed in with that regard. My second question goes to the second speaker, where he talked about the he talked about the growth, economic growth, and he also talked about how it is ruthless and how this growth does not that does not necessarily manifest in job creation and etc. I wanted to ask him, how do we go about ensuring that, of course, we cannot get rid of corruption, as you stated. But then we have various institutions, and I go by with what the sentiments that were brought up by my previous honorable speaker, that the ACC is one of the pivotal and most imperative tools that we can use to ensure that corruption is dealt with. But in some of the cases, especially with the budget, we see that in some cases, in some countries, including my own, that the budget is cut when it comes to ACC. Now, the ACC probably gets the crumbs in terms of in the budget, and it's not fully capacitated financially. Then you have a case where they are not able to pay their investigators. They are not able to ensure that they bring in more staff to help with the investigations and to help deal with cases. And then they're only limited to specific cases that they can deal with due to budgetary constraints. How do we then as Parliament ensure that we put pressure, given the fact that in some cases as parliamentarians, we normally just become a rubber stamp position, and are not even included in some of the consultations in the budget. But the ACC is normally excluded in terms of getting the budget that it deserves to curb corruption. So what are your thoughts with that regard?
Obrigada. Namíbia, tem outra mão?
Thank you, Namíbia. Have you raised a hand again? While we are waiting, we are going to give the opportunity to the presenters to answer the questions that have been posed.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I may begin with the first question, which was from Zambia, dealing with the appointment of certain officials. The scrutiny, especially of executive appointments, is an important aspect of oversight in many countries, and it usually involves lengthy investigations into the appointee's suitability for public office. And here we look at the appointments of, for example, ombudsmen, public protectors, human rights commissioners, cabinet members. And it is those kinds of appointments and politically exposed public officials who are at higher risk when they assume their positions. So the screening and vetting and verification, et cetera, is a process this that I would suggest needs to be transparent and accountable through the parliamentary process. And then to respond to the other question about how to get an answer to oral questioning, you know, research has shown that oral questioning is not always the best method, and in many legislatures, written questions are now more frequently used than oral questions. The written question has been found to be most popular because of the tight restrictions that are placed on notable oversight mechanisms, which must be submitted by a parliamentary party group or a committee or a minimum number of MPs. So, for example, in South Africa, the procedures governing questions are set out in both the rules of the National Assembly and in the rules of the National Council of Provinces. And here the rules prescribe the format and stipulate that questions for written reply are limited to 3 questions per member per week and must be replied to within 10 working days, provided that the responsible minister may in writing request the speaker for an extension not exceeding a further 10 working days on good cause shown. So if that can be incorporated into your rules, I think that will alleviate the failure of members to respond in the oral questioning sessions. I think those were the 2 questions that were directed at me. If I missed one, then please, please guide me.
Muito obrigada.
Thank you. Okay. I could add on the ACC. I've been campaigning for Anti-Corruption Commission since 2002, and one of the things that I've noticed, and we thought we had done well in engaging multilateral institutions to be interested in a establishment of AACCs. So you will notice that AACCs are now part of the bailout package. So if your country wants a bailout package, you must establish an AACC or EITI. So these bodies, while important, are no longer a product of an organic consensus, but they are now a product of external imposition and desperation on the part of broke bureaucrats who want money. So I want a bailout, so I'm going to establish an AACC, not because I really care about the AACC. So you get the AACC, you get out the bailout package. In the next 10 years, no funding for the AACC. The AACC is becoming basically a paper tiger, you know, a research center or an information disseminating platform. That happens when the work has not been done. So the role for me for legislatures is to build the field, do the painstaking, boring work of building an organic consensus, business, government, civil society. We need to have a platform and a body. You have that, and then we start talking about financing. We talk about the capacity. We talk about the laws of the AACC. To just focus on this and isolate everything else may not be the best. A lot of our AACC don't even have prosecutorial powers. They don't have investigating powers. At best, some of them are research centers that give suggestions to police. So you probably have to change the legal framework for that. Related to that is the question the honorable member from Zimbabwe raised, the question of laws. What happens when the laws are good but corruption continues to be high? And I'll give the example of a cake. What do you use to make a cake? Water, sugar, flour, milk, eggs. On their own, they don't make a cake, isn't it? They have to be put together at the same time and at a certain temperature. But on their own, no matter how important they are, it's just mere flour. So laws without the personnel, without the environment, the organic consensus and consciousness, without an economic system that is not rapacious, ruthless and jobless. And the overall delivery of personnel, the laws will not work. The laws have to work together with other variables at the same time. The last issue is on the difference between, you want to give BRICS examples so that this makes sense. There's a big difference between what happened in Russia in the early 90s, which is perestroika and glasnost, which was shock therapy. Sudden imposed liberalization, whereas with Deng Xiaoping, it was gradual, organic, and considered. So everyone had a stake, and everyone understood what was happening. So what you learn from the China and Russia examples is it change, whether it's in dealing with corruption or with economic development, it has to be organic. And it has to be a product of deep engagement of different sectors of society. Unless you have that, this idea that change will come by engaging IMF, AFDP, or some specific funder, it's not going to work. And this is why you find lots of strategies that were done by McKinsey that are rotting in cabinets. Because no one believes in that strategy. And no one is putting the work to engage the different sectors to develop a consciousness and a consensus around a certain topic. Thank you.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much. Now I'll give the floor to the secretary, to the committee secretary.
Honorable members, there was a question regarding documents, the sharing of documents, the presentations. We will indeed share the presentations. We just want to facilitate the process of translation into the three official languages, and then we'll be able to distribute. So please do expect to receive. If you don't receive, don't hesitate to ask. You would not have offended anyone. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much. I don't see any other raised hand.
Okay.
Also, yes, there is one. Lesotho, please. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much, Madam Chair. My question is based on the on what was said by the second presenter. He mentioned in his presentation that state capture by private interests affects formulation of laws, regulations, and regulations probably through payments. So I'm asking, we as legislators, how do we protect our region, our countries, against this type of corruption? Probably if you can just share with us his own observation, probably it could help. Thank you, Madam.
Muito obrigada.
Thank you very much.
Não vejo.
I don't see any other raised hand.
Não havendo, passo a palavra.
And so let me give the floor to the presenter.
Okay, that one is a whole workshop. Addressing state capture is a very complex question. And it is mainly many layers. There is no one answer to that. It's a multiple answer. But you will notice part of where we are is a fetish for foreign direct investment. You know, there is a school of thought that our country is not going anywhere until 10 Luxembourg companies, 7 Belgian, and 9 Indian come and save us from the quagmire that we are. So you have a lot of these companies that we have begged so much. Then they come walking very triumphantly to your country and basically capture your colleagues or your politicians. The colleagues are captured during the engagement meeting in London before they even invest. So I think it's looking inward. Maximize domestic capital and nurture domestic investment and domestic capital as a way to industrialize. I actually want to go back to. You don't have history of industrialization in Southeast Asia or even in the US or Europe, where you industrialize on foreign direct investment. It just never has that risk appetite. Eh? Where the risk comes from, the risk appetite usually comes from your state investment funds and domestic investment capital. And you work with that. Usually you grow together. That's how South Africa industrialized under apartheid. That's how China has done it. So it's just the overall a fetish we seem to have with big foreign companies coming to save us. I want to say change that paradigm on its head. You need to nurture domestic capital. That's number one, just as a broad point. The second one, which is sort of the boring PFM type work, is transparency. Too many negotiations are happening privately on the continent. Negotiation for things that are commons. So the commons will never be negotiated in private. That's why, in my view, you want to be transparent around key contracts, you know, power contracts, resources contracts. Why is that a secret? The state does it on behalf of our citizens, but we never know the terms of the discussions. Our bureaucrats are captured because they are competing with rich companies and negotiating in private. What protects you is negotiating in public so that everyone knows that this deal is unfair. All the countries that I know that have renegotiated and won renegotiated terms of contracts, the contracts were in the open. So anyone could compare, and I'll give an example. Rio Tinto comes from Australia. It operates in a number of jurisdictions. Rio Tinto can have a very good contract in country X and a very good contract in country Y. Why? But country X will never learn from country Y because both of them are secret. So you over give because you've been told that no one will come to get your coal. Unless you are producing Tanzanite, which is only found in Tanzania. There's no negotiation because you can only get the Tanzanite from Tanzania. And so negotiate in public. That's what I think. And they have a PFM framework that allows for competitive bidding. You want to sell a block of oil, submit your bids online. Everyone can see the provisions of the bid. A part of the problem is we think we can do all this privately and still get maximum benefit for the state and for the people. And I think that's where the problem comes in. I could go on and on, but for me, those are the top three key issues.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much. Now, if we don't have any more comments from the floor, after clarity on all the issues that have been raised, we've come to the end of our third session, so we go on the fourth, and the fourth session, then we'll go to the election for the chair and the vice chair, or from 2020 to 2024, and this session will be chaired by our secretary. But before that, allow me, dear colleagues, so that I can go to for my thank to my closing remarks, members of the Standing Committee. We started with the leadership of this committee at a time caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, where our meetings were virtual. Even so, thanks to the support from the SADC PF Secretariat, particularly from Mr. Shonine Kurasha, Committee Secretary, it was possible to continue with our mission.
Desculpe. Mesmo assim, graças ao apoio.
And thank you from the thank you to the help, especially. It was possible to fulfill our mission in this scenario. We appreciate and deliberated on various issues on our SADC region. The leadership that is coming to the end would like to thank the members for the dedication to discuss things in our region, and we would like to go with a sense of the fulfillment of duty, and we know that there is still something to be done, and so I would like to wish a success to and I would like to for the attention that you've had, I thank you. At this particular moment, I'll give the floor to my vice chair.
Thank you very much. Just to say that from our side, it's also been an honor to serve this committee. I think one of the most important things this committee has done is the, and I've always said it from the start, is to take the role model laws and work these role model laws into the countries. And obviously it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It's not that you can take the role model laws and say that what's good for Zimbabwe or what's good for Zambia is going to be good for South Africa, is going to be good for, you know, Malawi. But it's definitely a roadmap. And if we start today and we encourage all countries to start working towards reaching a time where all the countries can get us at a place where we could all have almost the same model laws, this committee could fundamentally change the way this region operates. And we're getting to a stage where the western regions, the eastern regions, and the northern regions are overtaking SADC and making SADC almost look like we're backwards, and all the others are experiencing growth. And it's upon us, as and this committee has that important challenge, to take us forward and to take the politicians forward. And that's why with both my cap as the treasurer and my cap as the outgoing vice chair, that when we turn this SADC into a parliamentary forum, a proper parliament, that we are the foundation of the role model laws. We here are the foundation of the people that are going to take these role model laws and teach our politicians in our country to embrace the role model laws. So please, the incoming chairpersons, the incoming vice chairpersons and this committee, take your role model laws seriously, promote the role model laws, and make sure that our election monitoring is made a priority. But I wish to thank everyone that was great team members, made our job easy, that supported our job. I wish to thank you all for making me feel at home and for a great term with all of you. And again, Mr. Grosha, it's been great to work with you as my colleague, and Madam Chair, it's been great to work with you as a partner and colleague. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and Vice Chairperson, for the kind words. And I wish to assure you that whatever good we did, it was with the guidance and support of the Secretary General, who has just stepped into the meeting. We recognize you, SG. Good afternoon. And we will always strive to do our best. One of the things that I have always cherished, or whenever I've been asked to say what makes a good parliamentarian, I've not hesitated to say a good parliamentarian is one that is willing to do the work. And we have seen members come and be members of the committee, grow in the committee, and been able to champion a lot of things. We have done quite a bit, particularly as mentioned by the Vice Chair, in championing the domestication of the SADC model law on elections. And we would want to continue to move in that direction, because part of what is missing in the democratization project or democratic consolidation project is the weakening of institutions or the eroding of public trust in institutions that emerge from flawed processes. And elections are one of those processes, and this committee therefore sits at the center of assisting the SADC Parliamentary Forum to be a champion in terms of its vision to continue to push frontiers for us to be able to see more gains, bring the region more closer to the citizens, and make this region a better place for the ordinary men and women, boy and girl. Thank you very much, honorable members. At this juncture, we are going to proceed to have elections. And allow me to project the procedural notes we are going to use to undertake elections so that we all stand guided. Honorable members, the tenure for the current chairperson and vice chairperson of standing committees and regional women's parliamentary caucus, who were elected in 2020 and served for a 2-year term, is coming to an end, and they should now retire by rotation. In this regard, the Secretariat has prepared this procedural guide to assist the members with the relevant provisions in the Constitution and the rules of procedure regarding elections for the chairpersons and vice chairpersons, as well as the eligibility of countries for the two positions. I was going to allow the chair and vice to say their farewell speech, which they have already done, and therefore allow me to move the next item, namely procedure for elections. The procedure for election of chairpersons and vice chairpersons of standing committees is provided for in Rule 39 of the Rules of Procedure, which states that, one, each committee shall elect a chairperson and vice chairperson. Two, the chairperson of standing committees shall preside over all meetings of the committee. In this, in his or her absence, the vice chairperson shall assume the duties. And in the absence of the vice chairperson, a member designated by the committee shall preside over the committee on an interim basis. Thirdly, there is a rotation principle. Article 14.3 of the Constitution of SADC PF provides for the principle of rotation in the election of chairperson and vice chairperson of standing committees as follows. Members of the standing committees holding the position of chairperson or vice chairperson shall retire by rotation, meaning that a member parliament with members serving in the positions of chairperson or vice chairperson of a standing committee shall not be eligible for re-election to the position in the immediate subsequent term. There is also a principle of gender. Rule 38.5 provides for the gender balance in the election of chairperson and vice chairperson of standing committees as follows. As far as it is practically possible, gender considerations shall be taken into account when deciding the chairpersonship of committees. Where the chairperson of a committee is a woman, the vice chairperson shall be a man and vice versa. Honorable members, I also wish to inform you regarding the procedure for nomination and election, which is as follows.
the returning officer will call for nomination for each of the two positions. Each nominee may be given time to present their credentials. If one nomination is received, the candidate shall be declared duly elected. If there are more than one candidate, election shall be held. Each member is eligible for one vote. Members shall vote by secret ballot, and only DG members are eligible to vote. And in the event of a tie, the chairperson shall have a casting vote. To facilitate the electoral process, the secretariat will circulate, will distribute ballot papers, and each eligible member will then write the name and country of the candidate of choice. They could also write just the name or just the country. It will suffice, as long as we can read your intention on the ballot paper. Honorable members, pay attention, because what I'm going to be saying is very important. We experienced spoiled ballot papers during the course of these elections, and as the Electoral Commission, we do not want to encourage spoiled ballot papers. This happened in circumstances where members, having nominated, written the names of their preferred candidate, also wrote their own countries or names. Secrecy of ballot means that we do not want to trace your vote to you. So if we are able to trace that vote to you, we duly regard that vote as invalid, because it doesn't meet the secrecy of the aspect. So for each position, when we open up for election, you simply write the name or the country of the candidate. You may not even worry about the position, because in any case, the positions are not held at the election, for each position are not held at the same time. So just write the name of the candidate or their country or both. Right. Honorable members, the procedure for elections also includes a schedule of chairpersons and vice chairpersons of the DGHR committee from 1999. To 2022. And this is important, because it then shows the countries that have held the position. What we may wish to bring to the attention of honorable members is that you will see that some countries held positions twice, more than once, before the rotation cycle was complete. This was only possible before 2013, when SADC PF, then, out of the desire to make sure that all the countries get an opportunity to hold positions, ruled out the holding of positions before the rotation cycle gets completed. And as such, we run our election in a way that allows all the members of the SADC PF, given the equal membership of parliament to SADC PF, an opportunity at one point or another to chair a committee. So these countries, I will not go through them. They are listed there. What I will go through are the countries that are still eligible by virtue of not having held the position before, in the spirit of completing the rotation cycle. For the position of chairperson, the ineligible countries will not read them out. They are in your file, what we distributed. But the eligible countries are DRC, Lesotho, Madagascar, Malawi, and Zimbabwe. For the vice chairperson position, the eligible countries are DRC, Lesotho, Madagascar, Mauritius, Malawi, Seychelles, and Tanzania. Honorable members, having confirmed the countries that are eligible, allow us to move to the next phase, which is the actual election. And at this juncture, I wish to find out if there are any questions so that we go into the elections having cleared any concerns that honorable members might have. I don't see any questions, therefore it clears the way for us to call for nominations for the position of chairperson for the DG committee. Honorable Zambia, your nomination.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Looking at the number of honorable members here, it is actually small, and the people we want to give these positions, all of us would have loved to get a position at least in the case of Zambia. However, if we go into interrogating these processes, what is good is that if male is chairperson, female must be deputy. Therefore, without wasting much of your time, allow me to nominate Honorable Daud Ndweni from Zimbabwe to become the next chairperson. I submit.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mayor Zambia. The nomination of Honorable Ndweni from Zimbabwe is duly noted. At this juncture, I wish to invite, if there is any seconder. I see Mozambique.
Muito obrigado. Quero secundar.
Thank you very much. I'd like to second Zambia's vote. I propose Zimbabwe.
Thank you very much, Honorable Agostinho, for the secondment. Honorable members, what this means procedurally is on the ballot paper, we have one candidate, Honorable Ndweni from Zimbabwe. At this juncture, I wish to open for further nominations. If there are any, are there any further nominations for the position of chairperson? Yes,
I would like to nominate the Madagascar, a candidate from Madagascar for chairperson.
Could you confirm the name of the candidate you are nominating if you know it?
Anyone from Madagascar, just to support the Indian Ocean.
In terms of our records, the name of the member from Madagascar is Honorable Siliva, and I therefore wish to state on the nomination papers the name of Honorable Siliva from Madagascar as a candidate for.
Her name is Marcy.
Sorry?
Marcy from Madagascar. Female.
Not for the DG committee, Honorable.
Okay.
The member for Madagascar for DG is Honorable Siliva. Going into this election, if Madagascar intended to change that, the procedure is that must be communicated to the Secretary General so that it is known. Madagascar, does that clarify issues? Madagascar, does that clarify the matter? It's okay? Okay. So, Honorable Siliva is a nomination submitted by Seychelles. Is there a seconder for the nomination of Madagascar for the position of chairperson? Honorable members, to facilitate the process, we would wish to receive a secondment for the nomination so that it is valid and can be stated on the ballot paper. Yes, Honorable.
J'appuie la candidature de Madagascar, Siliva.
Honorable members.
I support the candidature of Madagascar.
Sure. Maybe to assist honorable members. Eligible. Electoral College are members of the DG committee. So the representative of Madagascar in the committee is Honorable Tsiliva. There is nothing in the rules that prohibit Honorable Tsiliva from seconding his nomination if he so desires, but what we require is a secondment so that this becomes a regular nomination so that we are able to print our ballot paper. Honorable members, is there a seconder for Honorable Tsiliva's nomination?
Oui, merci pour votre aimabilité.
Thank you for your kindness for having proposed us as the chairperson, but I have no desire to become chair of this committee.
Thank you very much, Honorable Tsiliva. Honorable members, we have received as the returning officers communication from the proposed candidates as chairperson, Honorable Tsiliva, Christopher Tsiliva, that he wishes to withdraw as a candidate. Do we have any further nominations for the position of chairperson? I see Eswatin.
Mine is a question.
Sure.
Yeah.
You have the floor.
Earlier, you indicated that if there is a tie, the chair would be expected to cast his or her vote. Which chair were you talking about?
Sorry, the outgoing chair. Because the incoming one hasn't been decided. At a point when the incoming chair has not yet been decided, they can't have a casting vote. But once elected, they replace the outgoing. Mm-hmm. So whoever occupies the chair position will perform that role.
Okay. The reason I asked is because I saw the chair seconding. Is that not equal to a vote?
It isn't in the sense that the situation of a tie isn't a reason. So the chairperson also is entitled to a vote as a member. But when there is a tie, to break the tie, that's when you then request the chairperson to have the casting vote.
When she has already indicated her interest.
No, like I'm saying, Honorable, the first and foremost, the chair is a member like NR.
Yes.
So she is not deprived to take part in any of the activities of the committee unless so stated. So only when we have a situation of a tie, we then need to go to the person who occupies the position of chairperson to break the tie. So this situation hasn't arisen, and therefore we would do well for ourselves to cross the bridge when we have come to one. Are you answered, Eswatin? Thank you very much. Malawi?
I understand his concern. The Honorable Member, what he's trying to say is, if we go to a tie, it is a given position that the chair will go to where he's seconded. That's where his problem is. That's what I understood. Thank you.
I can say the problem. I will second the nomination. So therefore, the chair doesn't have to second the nomination, and therefore, the chairman's nomination doesn't. The seconding of the chair from the chairperson doesn't interfere with anything.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members. This committee of all the committees will handle the difficult questions and difficult things, and even contribute to the organic development of our electoral process, because that is your responsibility. So we have duly noted some of the observations that you are putting on board, which probably some of our rules may not have anticipated, And this is the spirit in which we are going to facilitate this process. So the point raised by Eswatini is noted, and I hope you have also noted our response. Equally, the observation made by Malawi and the nuances thereof are equally noted, and they will form part of our learning process as we go in terms of the rules. So having had that understanding, and I want to believe, Honorable Members, that we have therefore addressed this matter, or at least taken note of it, and we should now be able to proceed. I wish to give an opportunity to the chairperson, the outgoing chairperson, to address the meeting. I mean, to address the chair.
Muito obrigada.
Thank you very much. I did it under the... I was using my right to vote as a normal member, but if that is the case, if it has problems, then I withdraw my secondment.
Thank you very much, Honorable Agostinho, and I wish to state at this point that you have not violated any rule. There is no rule that prohibits you from exercising your rights like any other member. While we note, as I said, the important issues that have been raised by the other members. So we accept and appreciate your decision to withdraw from the secondment of the nomination, and we have duly recorded that the candidature of Honorable Ndweni from Zimbabwe has been seconded by South Africa Honorable Beckman. Honorable members, at this juncture, I wish to invite if there are any further nominations for the position of chairperson. Allow me to make a count of one. Honorable Tsiliva, you have a question.
Cher honorable, j'appuie le Zimbabwe.
Merci. I support Zimbabwe, the candidature of Zimbabwe.
Thank you very much, Madagascar. Your support for the candidate from Zimbabwe is duly recorded. At this juncture, in order to save time, honorable members, I wish to find out if there is any other nomination other than the one we have from Zimbabwe, so that we are able to conclude the process. So allow me to do a second count for the record. For the third time, honorable members, we wish to find out if there is any other candidate being nominated for the position. And I'm being invited to give him. So thank you very much, Honorable from Seychelles. So at this juncture, on account of having received a nomination, a single nomination, the sole nominee being Honorable Daud Ndweni from Zimbabwe, in terms of the constitution and the rules of procedure, I wish to declare Honorable Daud Ndweni from Zimbabwe as duly elected by unanimity the chairperson for the committee for the period 2022 to 2024. Congratulations, Honorable Ndweni. Honorable members, we need to conclude the electoral process, and the conclusion means we need to elect a vice-chairperson. Vice-chairperson, may I receive nominations? And the nominees we have, the countries that qualify, DRC, Madagascar, Mauritius, Malawi, Seychelles, and Tanzania. Is that, are you taking the floor to nominate?
No.
I skipped. Yes. Okay, let me do for the assurance of Honorable Mut and any other members. The eligible countries are DRC, Lesotho, Madagascar, Mauritius, Malawi, Seychelles, and Tanzania. At this juncture, I wish to invite for nominations for the position of Vice Chair. Yes, Honorable.
I would like to nominate Lesotho.
There is a candidate of Lesotho nominated by Namibia. Is there a seconder for that nomination? Is the Lesotho candidate seconded? I see Zimbabwe. May you speak through the mic for the record?
Thank you. Thank you, moderator. I second the candidature of Lesotho.
The candidature of Lesotho is seconded by Zimbabwe, except in terms of the golden standard set by with the nuance from Eswatini and in Malawi. If we will have a tie, we will need to break a tie through the vote of the chair. So, yes, Honorable Ambrose.
Yes, sir. I am once again going to nominate the Indian Ocean again. I nominate my colleague from Madagascar again.
At this juncture, allow me to dispense with the nomination of Lesotho first. We have a nomination from Lesotho, which needs a seconder. So allow me to receive a seconder, Malawi.
I second Lesotho.
Thank you very much, Malawi. So we have a nomination of Lesotho on the ballot, courtesy of a nomination from Namibia, seconded by Malawi. Honorable members, I wish to find out if there are any further nominations for the position of Vice Chairperson. I had given you the floor.
Yes, Mr. Secretary.
Yes.
I'm repeat again. I will nominate you, Madagascar, for the Vice Chairperson.
Thank you very much, officials, for the nomination. Could you please confirm the name of the candidate you are nominating?
Masi Gulamali.
Honorable Gulamali, in terms of records, you are not a member of the DG. The member of the DG from Madagascar is Honorable.
I am not a member, je suis pas membre du DG.
I'm not a member of the DG.
Sure. So that excludes the. I'm qualifying because she's not a member of the committee. We need a nomination of a member of the committee to the committee.
So, Mr. Secretary, then start the case. Then we go with Lesotho.
You are seconding.
Excusez-moi, président.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairperson. Thank you.
Yeah. Je le remercie beaucoup.
Thank you.
The one of the things that I always say, particularly in the Democracy and Governance Committee, This is where we organically develop the system. And that's why you see we are quick to record any observations that are useful in only strengthening what we are trying to build. And we will duly record and see how we infuse these observations. And we appreciate your grace. In this matter. Issues of elections, honorable members, you are product of election. It can be tough sometimes, but thank you for allowing us to do it with a smile. So at this juncture, I wish to find out if there is any further nomination for the position of vice chair. The issue is if we have not received nominations, we can't know. So we want to cross the bridge when we have confronted one. We should start jumping before the bridge appears. When the matter goes to court and there's a challenge, the affidavit will say the returning officer was busy anticipating a situation that had not arisen. Madagascar.
Oui, et je porte mon soutien à Lesotho.
Thank you very much. So, honorable members, for the last time,
support Lesotho.
The support for Lesotho is recorded. For the last time, honorable members, are there any further nominations for the position of vice chairperson? Having received one candidate for the position of vice chairperson of the DG committee for the period 2022 to 2024, I wish, by the powers vested in me as the returning officer on behalf of the Secretary General, to duly declare Honorable Mtala Mafa as duly elected vice chairperson of the committee. Congratulations. The biggest winner is democracy. And congratulations.
Félicitations.
At this juncture, I wish to give the floor to the vice chairperson. You can speak from where you are to, in a minute or so, to deliver your acceptance speech.
Thank you very much, our returning officer. Really, I don't even have probably sufficient words to thank you, honorable members, for having trusted me into the chairmanship position. I know, really, this is my first time to be in this committee. And it's our first time to come across each other as we've been... our main obstacle was the COVID-19 issue, of which you know very well that we managed to communicate or to hold our meetings virtual. Honorable members, I know you'll help us probably to go through this hard work we are facing. I know you are knowledgeable people in as far as democracy is concerned. And I'm still really hoping that I'm just going to get a very good support from you, honorable members. Thank you very much.
Honorable Mafa, what I can assure you is that SADC is not afraid of giving people responsibility even if they are coming for the first time. And I've seen this happen in my lifetime. And we look forward to your leadership. At this juncture, I wish to hand over to the chairperson, Honorable Ndiweni, to first to deliver his acceptance speech, and then secondly to proceed and close the meeting. I wish to inform members that the outstanding engagement with the pending engagement with the consultant will be pursued through other alternative means because they have had to go for COVID tests. So as a result, the chair, you will have the opportunity to deliver your closing remarks and also to close the meeting. If you have grace before you close the meeting, you might wish to give the Secretary General an opportunity to say a few things in case she has. She's in the meeting. Thank you. Over to you, Honorable Ndwe.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moderator. Fellow honorable members, I would like to thank you for the confidence and trust that you have bestowed in us, the two of us as a team. It's not going to be an easy ride, but I'm not afraid. I'm very optimistic. A good leader is determined by the flock that he is leading. And considering the caliber of honorable members that we have in our committee, I definitely feel I will never fail because I have very strong lieutenants around me. Honorable members, the task ahead of us is mammoth. We are coming into this committee. Some of you are new, some of us are old members. But this is a very interesting and challenging time of the forum, in that we are at a transition period. So all these past years, we were a forum, and we were clamoring to be recognized by the SADC heads of state. Clamoring that they recognize the formation of a regional parliament, which is a SADC parliament. And that this was agreed. If you were not aware, it was agreed. So now we are in the process of going into our long dreamt of a SADC parliament. So this then gives us a very unique position that we find ourselves in. I would have loved that if processes would be quickened, that we were to, if we could establish the parliament within our tenure in the 2 years, but I don't think that's possible. But it really depends on this committee as well. Looking at the committees of this organization, all the committees, I normally see this committee as the engine of SADC PF. Why do I say so? Because we deal with governance. So governance is key to even the formation of this organization. It's governance. Governance is the key word. If we look at the Committee of Finance, if there's good governance, you have money. You look at the Committee for Women, if there's good governance, women will be incorporated. We won't even be reminding everyone that women should be incorporated. We look at gender, we look at food and agriculture. With good governance, everything falls in place. So we find ourselves in a very critical position of the forum, so much so that I'm confident, like I said, with your assistance, no job will be insurmountable. I thank you once again for your confidence that you had. Thank you.
The Secretary General indicates that you stole all her words in your earlier utterances, and as such, she is requesting to be allowed to be marveling at you having preempted her words. I'm sure the SU will indulge you.
Good afternoon, honorable members. Is it good evening now? Let me congratulate the outgoing leadership of this committee and thank them for the work that they have done during their tenure. Allow me to also congratulate the incoming leadership of this committee for the mammoth task that is before them. We look forward to you taking the committee beyond where it was currently. You've done a roadmap for this committee, which was presented to you this morning. I like the fact that you insisted on timelines, among others, that is a smart way of working. And we look forward to that integration that the chairperson has just alluded to, in ensuring that your themes, your norms around democracy are reflected in the activities that this committee is going to be able to follow through. It is very interesting, the issue of elections and the lessons that we are gathering from these sessions. The issue of conflict of interest seems to have come up in more than one committee this time around, and I believe that that is an area that this committee can assist us to look at much more in depth, to preempt scenarios of where conflict of interest may arise. There's another issue, which while we appreciate that elections follow principles of democracy, that leadership comes out of legitimacy, the governance issues that must be integrated in how we do things. And therefore, we are also observing and learning that while we have the majority of English-speaking countries, while we have the rotation system in place in terms of how we nominate, we may find that we're eclipsing other countries by virtue of the numbers that they have at the forum. The rules are very clear. We believe that the rotation principle will get us there. But it's an area that we'll also understand and respond back to the members. And I believe this committee may assist us as we go ahead. So congratulations and thank you. And the issues that you've dealt with are quite clear. And they are fully related to the norms of democracy and human rights, among others. And we look forward to your action plans and your debates during the plenary assembly. You've been well equipped to engage with the matters. It will also be helpful for you to look at your scenarios at country level and locate yourself within the discourse in order for you to argue from a practical perspective when the matter has been tabled by the plenary assembly. Thank you very much, and congratulations, Gurasha, Paulina, and the other colleagues for running this committee quite well. Thank you.
Chair, over to you.
Is there anything else, any announcements, Mr. Koresh?
As far as the business of the committee is concerned, there isn't. If there are any other administrative matters that may come up, we may deal with them through alternative means, including our groups and desk officers. At this juncture, there are no more issues on the agenda of the committee, Chair.
Thank you very much. Fellow honorable members, unfortunately, I wasn't given a chance to give you a chance in case there was somebody amongst our own who wanted to say a word. Is it procedural, if I can ask?
We are at your disposal, Chair.
Yes. Is there anyone amongst the honorable members that has anything to say before we close? Nothing. All right. That's democracy. I'm trying to extend it. This is the first time. Thank you very much, honorable members, and thank you for coming to this meeting. Your participation and your votes as well, more so your votes. I'm elated. I would like to wish you a pleasant journey, messages as you go back to your respective countries, and till we meet again. Asante sana. Thank you.
Thank you, obrigado. Thank you, honorable members, and all the best. And I join the chair in wishing you safe travels. And thank you very much for bringing your energy to the meeting. It always encourages us when we do some preparatory work and members find it useful and make use of it. If you have any work at national level, or you are tackling a question that deals with democracy and governance, remember, we are at your disposal. We are a text away. We'll be willing and be happy to know what you're doing and find out how we could support. So let's keep in touch. Thank you. Our online participants, thank you very much. Members of the Technical Working Group, we see you. Thank you very much for participating in the meeting.
Recording stopped.
We maintain the conversation. Thank you very much. And ICT, you may terminate. Honorable Mutu. Oh, okay. When you are done. No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Chief. Thank you. We appreciate the support. Thank you for supporting the chairperson. Yeah, we Yes. I see you. Okay, let's terminate.
Where are you studying?
Yes.